Welcome to the Recruiting Rant Podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez, senior analyst for USCFootball.com. Going with the new intro song this month, that's the GZA, Fourth Chamber, from the album Liquid Swords. Perhaps, in my opinion, one of the greatest hip-hop albums ever produced. USC trying to produce one of its best recruiting classes of the last decade. However, the Trojans slipped to number 7 nationally in the team recruiting rankings over the 4th of July weekend. But Trojans falling behind LSU and Oregon in the team recruiting rankings, despite obtaining the commitment of Mission Hill's Bishop Alemany 4-star athlete Jalen Smith last week. We'll see if there's any comments, complaints, or concerns about that little bit of news in the Recruiting Rant Podcast this week. So without further ado, let's get to the questions. Our first question comes from Gus Yock, who says, "Hey, Jim, what prospects do you think would have fulfilled their potential on a different team or with more playing time? I always think Dominic Davis or Marvell Tell could have made a bigger impact given the right situation." Marvell Tell was a pretty decent player for USC. He was a multi-year starter, was all Pac-12 both his junior and senior years. On the other hand, I think if Dominic Davis would have stayed committed to Washington State, he would have had a better career. He's not a natural running back in terms of vision, but I think within that offense, with his speed, he would have had a much better career. Would he have gotten drafted? Would he have been all Pac-12? It's hard to say, but he definitely would have contributed to Washington State's offense, and I think he would have been better off there in comparison to being at USC, where he moved to cornerback and had a mixed bag of running back coaches. Going back a little further, two other names that come to mind are Devon Flournoy and Trevon Patterson. Both of those wide receivers, at one time or another at USC, had really good stretches in practices, in scrimmages, but for whatever reason, they just couldn't break that just happy to be here mold and never really contributed much for USC. The next question comes from Dowdle15, who asked, "Where does SC stand with Damon Payne, and how much of a chance do they have with him?" I said Dowdle. It might be Doodle. I don't speak Peristylenian as my first language, so I apologize. You guys can always reach out to me on the Peristyle if I mispronounce your name. As for Damon Payne, the 6'4", 300-pound defensive tackle out of Bellevue, Michigan, the number 2 ranked defensive tackle in the country, I don't think USC has a good shot. I've heard for probably the better part of 3 months that Payne was headed to Alabama. Alabama was the clear leader, and he was most likely going to commit to Alabama before the start of the season. I think USC is intriguing to him. I think the West Coast is intriguing to him. And we talked about this on the Peristyle maybe a month ago when Payne's name came up as a potential official visitor. I think that's where USC is trying to get their foot in the door. And they have had some success recruiting Michigan. When you look at some of the top recruits that USC has recruited in the past decade plus, going back to the Pete Carroll era, two of the most highly rated players that USC has ever signed out of the state came from Michigan. Ronald Johnson, who is from Muskegon, Michigan, and Nick Perry, who is from Detroit, Michigan. Ronald Johnson was a 5-star cornerback out of Muskegon, Michigan, and he wanted to play wide receiver. USC afforded him that opportunity. He signed with USC. And Nick Perry kind of floated under the radar a little bit. He was actually looking at Michigan State, and USC was able to swoop in on him late. Now, I realize neither Johnson nor Perry were defensive tackles, and recruiting defensive tackles outside the region is very difficult. It's not as difficult to do when you're working the Midwest as it is the Southeast. USC, even in their heyday, when they're trying to win 3 straight national championships, were having any success recruiting defensive tackles out of the South. I don't know what it is. Offensive linemen, they've had some success. You look at EJ Price, Achiuma Adoga, they've had some success recruiting some top offensive linemen, even in the South. But when it comes to defensive tackles in general, they have had very, very little success. And people always mention, what about Leonard Williams? Leonard Williams was originally from Southern California. He moved to Florida, and he had a bunch of family who still lived in Southern California. So with Payne, he's from Michigan. Like I said, USC has had some traction in the past recruiting Michigan players. And it's one of those type of prospects where you want to bring him in late in the process. We're not sure how the early signing period is going to go. So maybe you can bring him in December and it's snowing and it's cold in Michigan and he comes out to Southern California and he vibes with the lifestyle. But having said that, I've heard Alabama, Alabama, Alabama for the last 3 months. So this is going to be a work in progress for USC. He may commit to Alabama before the season starts. USC is going to continue to recruit him, and they have to try to get that official visit late in the year. The next question comes from Beta Trojan 64, who asks, any comparisons for Isaiah Johnson, and how do you like USC's chances of landing him? Isaiah Johnson, the 6'2", 185-pound, four-star cornerback from Bluefield, West Virginia, originally from Atlanta, Georgia. He just transferred out here, going to St. Bernard's High School, although he has yet to determine where he's going to actually play football next fall, if there is a football season. I really haven't seen him enough in person to go into my mental database and try to make a comparison with a past player that USC's recruited or signed. I will say in terms of his recruitment, I like USC's chances right now. Although when you got a player that bounces around a little bit, not necessarily from high school to high school, but from state to state, there's always that potential he decides to pick up and leave and go back to Atlanta or maybe even West Virginia next week. So right now, the way things look, I really like USC's chances. He has a great relationship with USC cornerbacks coach Dante Williams. I think he has a very good relationship with a couple other coaches in the South. But despite what he says, being out in Southern California and being close to USC, once recruiting opens up, he's going to be able to familiarize himself with the USC campus, with the USC football team, the players specifically, being around them, building a relationship with some of those players on the team, and then, of course, building a relationship with the rest of the coaching staff, not just Dante Williams. But Dante Williams is obviously the driving force here. And because you have an elite recruiter at that position, you have to like USC's chances of landing Johnson. Our next question comes from NJ Trojan, who asks, Ethan Calvert, still a SC-FUCLA battle? UW board saying that it's a Washington-UCLA battle. What are you hearing? Ethan Calvert, a 6'3", 230-pound, four-star inside linebacker from Oaks Christian High School. The latest intel I have is it's still a UCLA-USC battle. Washington is still involved, Stanford's still involved, Utah's still involved, but USC and UCLA seem to be at the top. He's still talking to the USC coaching staff weekly, if not biweekly, and although we don't expect a commitment from him in the near future, meaning within the next probably 3 weeks, I do think there's a good chance that he makes a decision before mid-September. I think he wants to get a decision done earlier rather than later, but at this point he's just going through the process, and while there's still a good handful of schools involved, the Bruins and the Trojans are the ones that come up in conversation the most with the sources that I talk to. The next question is from Amy USC, who says, GM, if there's no football this season, how will that affect USC recruiting for the 2021 class? It's certainly going to impact recruiting, but we can only speculate as to the extent negatively or positively it has on the class. As I've said before, USC has a tough schedule. There are games on that schedule where they could be embarrassed, and that would have a negative impact on the recruiting class. On the flip side, if you're not playing those games, then you don't have the risk of being blown out by Alabama or being beaten on the road at Oregon. That's a positive because it doesn't disrupt the momentum of the class, the momentum that USC has built up recruiting over the summer, and it allows them to focus specifically on recruiting throughout the rest of the year. At the same time, you could argue that USC was going to have a really good year this year, the defense was going to be different, the offense was going to really take off with Keaton Slovis coming back, and having another year in the system, which Graham Harrell had talked about in the past, really year number two is the real jump that you see in that offensive system. So if you have greater offensive production and you have better defensive play on paper, USC wins more games, and that in itself would help recruiting even more. even if you lose a game or two, you go out there and you're competitive against Alabama, maybe you upset Oregon on the road, that would improve recruiting even more. So you can argue that it will handicap recruiting to some extent if you're optimistic about how USC is going to play on the football field this season. Ultimately, I would think that it will help USC on the defensive side of the ball, which we've already seen USC is recruiting really well on the defensive side of the ball right now. Then on the offensive side of the ball, perhaps it hurts them because they're not going to be able to have that big year where they're going to put up a bunch of impressive numbers, specifically at the wide receiver position and then also at the quarterback position. Now, USC doesn't really need a lot of help in quarterback recruiting right now. They have a commitment from Miller Moss and they have a commitment from Jake Garcia, two four-star quarterbacks that are among the top quarterbacks in the nation. But the wide receiver position, and that position was probably going to have a big year in that offense. That's going to be harder because right now USC is struggling with options, and the season was probably going to help them recruit. They were going to be able to show off some big numbers and have Amon-Ra St. Brown and Tyler Vaughns on their way out going to the NFL and be able to showcase those two players for recruits. The next question comes from David Law, who says, "Hi there, GM. Two questions as usual. The first is a repeat of a few weeks ago. As I'm just looking to see if there's any significant changes, which of the guys on the SC's target list that have high interest should we feel most confident about? Second, does the recruiting prowess of the new and improved coaching staff give you any good feelings about the skill in which they'll use to coach the team, or the abilities to recruit and coach completely unrelated?" Last question first. I think they're mostly unrelated, although I think there is something to be said from a motivational standpoint that a coach like Dante Williams will relate to his players better, and perhaps his players will play harder for him because they trust him and they believe in him. And I think in general, defensive back coaching will see an uptick. I think you're going to see an improved defensive backfield from the standpoint of coverage and the standpoint of tackling in the open field. You've got two coaches there now dedicated to specifically coaching the quarterbacks and specifically coaching the safeties. And I think that in and of itself will help the defensive secondary. As for the first question, I think there's two players that stand out on the USCfootball.com target list right now that have high interest in USC, which things have sort of shifted for them a little bit. First being Josh Simmons, the 6'6", 270-pound offensive guard from La Mesa Helix High School, who wants to be recruited as a defensive lineman going forward. He's still labeled as having high interest in USC, and I think his interest is very high in USC, but playing defensive line and how he is recruited as a defensive lineman will be perhaps a deal breaker in his recruitment. And we really have to sort of wait and see how USC approaches that. So I'm a little sort of on the fence with him being high interest, but I think because inherently he's a USC fan, he loved USC growing up, he looks at USC and feels comfortable at USC when he's been there on unofficial visits, I feel like that in itself warrants high interest. And again, what I said before, I think it was last week when I defined the differences between high interest and medium interest. High interest, we're talking about a player that has USC in his top two or three. Medium interest, we're talking about a player which USC still has a decent chance of getting on an official visit. The other player that I would say that has high interest in USC that I'm wavering on a little bit is Nathaniel Wiggins, the 6'2", 170-pound four-star cornerback from Atlanta, Georgia. Not necessarily because I think USC has dropped for him significantly. It's just that we haven't heard much about him or from him in a little over a month. And so knowing that he's from the Southeast and knowing that USC has some really good options outside of him makes me a little wary as to how high his interest is in USC. I will say that I still believe USC is among his top two or three, so that by definition would give him high interest in USC from a target list standpoint. I also think Isaiah Johnson, who now is being labeled as having high interest on the target list, I think he's a guy that you would put in that group of pretty confident with. But again, as I stated earlier, being that he's jumped around a little bit from high school to high school, from state to state, you always know that that could work against you in a couple weeks, next month, maybe 3 months from now. He decides he's going to move from Southern California, he's going to go back to Atlanta, or he's going to go to Texas, et cetera, et cetera. We're really not going to know what happens with the high school football season. There is potential that CIF cancels it, and maybe there's another state that decides they want to push through and they want to have a high school football season. We've already talked to a number of high-ranked recruits that say they're going to play high school football this season no matter what. And if they've got to move out of state to go play high school football, that's what they're going to do. Now, that's what they say they're going to do. It's a little more complicated than that. But with a guy like Isaiah Johnson, who's already moved around and gone across the country in the middle of a pandemic to go to St. Bernard's High School and perhaps play for St. Bernard's next fall, if there's no football and that rug is pulled from underneath him, potentially he decides to go somewhere else. And I think then that hurts USC's chances. Significantly, I don't know. He says that distance is not a factor. He was looking at USC and interested in USC when he was living in West Virginia. But I think being able to have a player close, local, for him to be able to be on campus, for him to be able to go down and watch practices, all of that definitely helps the school that's closest. The next question comes from Mix, who says, "Great job as usual. Thank you. Two questions. Number one, outside of Corey Foreman and the two committed quarterbacks, what committed, parentheses, if one decommits, USC player, and what uncommitted player from Southern California, parentheses, San Diego included, would be the biggest loss for USC? Number two, can you get into as many details as possible without throwing anybody under the bus on how LSU, quote-unquote, bullied USC in the recruitment of Dwight McLeatherin?" Second question first, there's really no throwing anybody under the bus. Yes, LSU has better recruiters or had better recruiters than USC. Specifically on the defensive side of the ball at that point in time, you're talking about Corey Raymond as a defensive back coach. Corey Raymond is one of the best defensive back coaches, if not the best defensive back coach in college football. He's also one of the best recruiters in college football. You have Ed Orgeron as the head coach at LSU, who is a notable recruiter himself. Competing against USC, whose football season was over at that point, LSU was still competing for a national championship. They would go on to win the national championship and have an undefeated season with the Heisman-winning quarterback. USC couldn't compete with that. USC couldn't compete with that from a standpoint of player development, from a standpoint of positional recruiting, and they actually couldn't even compete with location because LSU is closer to Houston, where McLeatherin's from, than USC is. Now, McLeatherin was silently committed to USC for a couple months, but that week, LSU comes in, says, "Hey, we're going to offer you a scholarship." McLeatherin flipped that week. So that's really kind of the definition of getting bullied. When you've got a kid secured, ready to go to your school, and another program that's playing at a higher level of football comes in and just nudges you out of the way and says, "Nah, we're going to take him instead." And that's basically what happened. McLeatherin, as a silent commitment to USC for more than a month, was offered a scholarship from LSU, decided to take that scholarship offer from LSU the week he was going to announce his commitment to USC. Bullied. USC used to do the same thing to other schools back in the Pete Carroll era. They'd be able to come in with a late offer on a recruit that was clearly a plan B, but it didn't matter. Even when the recruit knew he was a plan B, he'd take that scholarship offer from USC and decommit from the other school. As for the first question, biggest losses for committed and uncommitted players, Kalen Bullock, the 6'2", 175-pound safety slash athlete out of Pasadena Muir High School would be a big loss for USC. They need safeties. I think losing Brandon Campbell would be pretty big as well, just because they need running backs. You know, big losses for me are a balance between how talented a player is and then the need at that position. So with USC wanting to sign two running backs, losing Campbell would be big. And I'd say along those lines of uncommitted players, USC losing Byron Cardwell, the 6'1", 195-pound four-star running back from San Diego, would be a big loss as well. Because you need two quality running backs in this class. You're losing two quality running backs to graduation in Stephen Carr and Vi Melapai. Another player you have to inevitably put on that list would be Kingsley Suamataia, the 6'6", 285-pound four-star offensive tackle from Orem, Utah. USC needs offensive tackles. He is one of the best offensive tackles in the Western region. That's a difficult miss to rationalize. Now, Oregon clearly has the angle. He goes to Orem. That's Penei Sewell's high school. Another miss that USC had recently on the recruiting trail that went on to a rival school and has been outstanding for them. So there's plenty of explanation. It's understandable why he would go to Oregon over USC, but that doesn't mean that it's still not a miss from a positional need standpoint. The next question comes from P. Polly, who says, I live here in Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth, and I notice that USC has been covering the state as best as it can. Would it make sense for USC to have a recruiting office in Texas, considering the size of the state as well as the amount of athletes here? Maybe I'm not understanding the word quote-unquote office here, but USC cannot officially have an office in Texas. The support staff cannot recruit off-campus, and during the season, they would be the only ones that would be able to focus on recruiting while the position coaches were coaching. And even then, a lot of the support staff doubles in and helps out with quality control. Chris Claiborne himself is going to be a quality control analyst, and so he's going to help out the offense with reviewing film and self-scouting. So you need to have them on campus when you're practicing during the season. Now, if you're saying we're not going to have a season and the USC assistant coaching staff can specifically focus on recruiting and not actually coaching during the season, I still don't think it makes any sense. Why not just stay at a hotel? Texas is a big state. Having a headquarters, you're never going to have a centralized location where you're going to be close to all the recruits. If you're having to travel between DFW and Houston and Central Texas and East Texas, you're still going to have to travel. So with cell phones and laptops and the ability to communicate via the internet, you could just be at a hotel and just have your coaches come and go through a hotel. So I don't think a centralized location really makes sense unless you're talking about the sports staff. And I said before, support staff cannot recruit off campus according to the NCAA. So that's a non-starter. The next question comes from Cassius, who says, hey, GM, thanks as always for the pod. Definitely the highlight of the week. Couple questions for you. Number one, it's nice to be in his top eight and all, but any legit shot at Mason Smith, I'd be shocked. I'd be pretty shocked too, at least right now. Maybe USC can get an official visit and things change, but sitting here in July, I'd be shocked if USC signs the five-star out of Louisiana. Cassius' second question is, removing Dante Williams for the purpose of this question, who among the new staff members has impressed you the most with regards to recruiting? You're the best. I'd say Craig Kniver. Craig Kniver's name came up with USC targets before USC officially hired Dante Williams. So while Dante is getting a lot of credit for the defensive backfield recruiting, and he deserves a lot of credit, I knew before they even officially hired Dante Williams that he was going to make a big impact on USC recruiting in the defensive backfield and beyond. However, that is overshadowing the fact that Kniver has done a tremendous job recruiting those safeties. And I think in general, he's a very good recruiter. I'd like to see USC go more to an area-based recruitment instead of just recruiting by position, but going by territory, because a guy like Kniver, I think his talents as a recruiter could be used at other positions. I totally understand the rationale that USC is using from a strategy standpoint, recruiting by position over territory right now. Under the circumstances of quarantines, recruiting, being in a dead period, not being able to go on campuses at high schools and talk to high school coaches and talk to recruits, I understand where you want to get right into having your positional coaches, building a relationship with the players and the recruiting targets at their position. I totally get that rationale. But I think in most years, a guy like Niver, and even really Dante Williams, this is true also, you kind of sort of waste their talents by having them focus exclusively on a position and not necessarily on an entire territory or territories, where you could have them maybe recruiting San Diego and then maybe DFW or Central California and Houston. You want to be able to have your best recruiters be able to go out there and recruit multiple positions. And to some extent, Dante Williams is doing that anyways, because he is involved to some extent with Corey Foreman's recruitment. And obviously, Corey Foreman is not going to play defensive back. But I think in general, on a normal schedule, in a normal year, you would want to have those guys be able to overlap and recruit as many players as possible, because they're good recruiters. They're good salesmen. They know how to relate and talk to recruits, and that's huge. The next question comes from BND1, who asks, Jim, great work as usual. Do you expect any new USC commits prior to August 1st? If so, at what positions? Boy, you guys are always trying to brace me with these questions about commitments and silent commitments and trying to out the silent commitments. I'll say this. I believe USC will get commitments from the defensive line position, the cornerback position, and I do think they'll get a commitment at the linebacker position before the end of August. That's really the window we're looking at. That's the summertime commitment window. Now, classically, that window exists because players want to get a decision done before the start of their senior year and before the start of their senior football season. Now, we know the football season may not happen at the high school level, and their senior year is going to happen, but it may happen online. So how is that going to impact how prospects look at committing early and getting it done, because they don't want to have to worry about recruiting? If you're not going to be on campus in high school and you're not going to have a football season, do you still need to make that commitment in August? We have to wait and see. That's a complete unknown right now. But I do think in that window, you'll see commitments at those positions. I will also add this, and this is really just for the podcast. I don't want to discuss this on the Peristyle. I don't really want this to linger in a thread where you have the trolls and lurkers from other fan bases who will jump in on the thread. I figure at this point, halfway through the podcast, most of the other fans from other schools are not listening at this point. I will say this, I do expect USC to have two decommitments before the beginning of September. I'll say that that summer window time, I think there's a good chance you actually see USC have two decommitments. One is an obvious one, and we've kind of talked about it already. The other is not, and it comes off of very recent information. And so we'll see how that plays out. It's not a for sure thing right now, but there's definitely potential that USC has two decommitments before the beginning of September. Our next question comes from Earl Warren, who says, Hi Jim, thanks for doing this. Have you found connecting with recruits and their families has changed over the last few years? Are folks more wary to talk to you as a member of the media? Are kids and families easier to get a hold of given the proliferation that's English of social media? A sort of follow-up question. What recruit did you personally have the best connection with? Thanks. Really good questions. I'll answer the last one first. For me, it's always going to be Kyle Moore. It was, I believe, my first week, maybe the second week that I was working full-time for USCFootball.com. This was the first call that I ever made out of state to a recruit, and it was to Kyle Moore. Defensive end from Houston County. He's a four-star. He'd officially visit USC, and I had gotten wind that he and DeSean Jackson had called Pete Carroll after the national championship game and silently commit. So I called Kyle Moore. We had a great conversation, amazing personality, one of the most gregarious recruits that I've talked to since. And I asked him, towards the end of the interview, hey, I heard there was a rumor that a couple guys silently commit to Pete Carroll after the national championship game. Have you heard anything about that? And he played it off, said, no, I haven't heard anything about that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who that would be. I'm not really sure who commit. You know, that's pretty interesting. And so we hung up the phone, and 5 minutes later, he calls me back. And he says, Mr. Martinez, I just kind of want to let you know I commit. I actually called Coach Carroll and I told him that I want to go to USC, but I don't want it out. I still got this official visit to Miami and I want to take that official visit. And I really don't want anybody to know that I commit to USC. So that meant a lot to me. That meant a lot to me because he was trusting me with that information and he didn't know me from Adam. He didn't know me at all. That's the first conversation we ever had. And I told him, I said, you know what? Your word is safe with me. I'm not going to say anything. I'll have a story ready to go. Once you're ready to announce, you just let me know and give me the green light. And then the story will go up. And so he took his official visit to Miami. And then I think he announced on Fox Sports Southeast right before signing day. As for the first question, it's pretty complicated. I could probably do a podcast just on this very topic. The short answer is yes. When you have major news outlets, take your pick, editorializing and manipulating information, falsifying facts to push whatever agenda, political or otherwise, in their reporting, it trickles downhill. When someone looks at a major news outlet making up a story or twisting and manipulating a story, they think to themselves, well, why should I trust this diddly little sports website? There's probably even less accountability and ethics when it comes to online reporting. Obviously, what I do is completely different than CNN and Fox and MSNBC, etc. But at the end of the day, I've got a press credential and it says media on it. And if people are distrustful of the media, then they perhaps are distrustful of me. So you are swimming upstream a bit. All you can do is put your best foot forward, allow your interactions and your writing to show what you're about. And to be blunt, I don't have a problem with earning people's trust. Whether it takes months or years over the course of a prospect's recruitment, I have no problem, nor do I take offense at someone not trusting me at face value just because I'm media. If it takes our interactions and my writing to build that trust, our relationship will be that much stronger because at the end of the day, trust is a two-way street. The next question comes from Nation of Troy, who says, hey GM, with Josh Simmons basically off the board at offensive line, do you anticipate USC to start offering more linemen or do you believe that the staff is comfortable with the three current commits? My second question is how you would rank the current defensive line targets based on the staff's interest of player and the player's interest in USC. Thanks. USC really only wants to sign four offensive linemen. They could sign five if they were able to get two offensive tackles or an offensive tackle like Kingsley Suamataia plus a Josh Simmons. As you said, Josh Simmons potentially off the board at offensive line. It certainly looks that way at present date. So I think they're really just looking for that other offensive tackle, whether that be Suamataia, Bram Walden, Travis Lee. I do think maybe USC is waiting to see what happens with Oregon. Potentially, you could have Kingsley Suamataia commit to Oregon, and then maybe that shakes loose Bram Walden. If at that point Walden remains solidly committed to Oregon, perhaps that's when USC starts initiating more scholarship offers at the offensive tackle position. As for the second question, I don't want to go through every recruit that USC has offered a scholarship on the defensive line in the 2021 class to. The main names that you have to keep an eye on are JT Tuimoloau, Tia Sevilla, who is now actually ranked as a defensive lineman for 24/7 Sports. He's a three-star strong side defensive lineman, actually rated the number 23 strong side defensive end by 24/7 Sports, which is a spot ahead of Aaron Armitage. Aaron Armitage is another player on the defensive line that you have to keep an eye on if you're following USC football recruiting. To a lesser extent, Damon Payne, we talked about him a little bit already in the podcast, and Mason Smith as well, who we talked about. That's kind of the group in terms of the players USC is recruiting hard and the players that are looking at USC seriously. The next question comes from SCPA5, who asks, thoughts on Nathaniel Wiggins to USC now with Isaiah Johnson becoming bigger on their board? We kind of talked about this already. I do think that Isaiah Johnson is a great option for USC. I think USC is in a very good position as long as Isaiah Johnson remains local. Not that they wouldn't have a shot at him if he decided to go back to West Virginia or perhaps move back to Atlanta where he's originally from, but I definitely think that it's an advantage to have him closer. I'm still hearing USC is top three for Nate Wiggins, but obviously with Isaiah Johnson there and potentially Clinton Burton being another option, it makes signing Wiggins a little less crucial. The next question comes from Super Trojan 5, who says, thanks, Gerard, for your work. I'm a big fan of the recruiting podcast. Could you tell us the story about Adoree Jackson choosing USC? Is it true that he almost went to Florida and there was drama with his letter of intent? Could you please tell the story of how Lane Kiffin became head coach at USC and the involvement of Keyshawn Johnson? The only story that I can share with you about Adoree Jackson, or Lane Kiffin for that matter, is when Adoree Jackson was supposedly going to officially visit UCLA right before signing day. And I remember all of the hype because Adoree had tweeted as if he was at UCLA. If I recall, Puff Daddy had a concert at UCLA or on UCLA's campus or near UCLA's campus, and a bunch of recruits were going to be there. Puff Daddy's son was a player at UCLA at the time. So everybody, and I say everybody, USC fans were really nervous about Adoree Jackson going to UCLA at the last minute. What was comical about that is a source had told me minutes after that tweet went out, Adoree Jackson's on campus at USC right now. He literally just tweeted that, and he's standing with the coaching staff at USC. So here he was implying how he was having this great time at the concert, and all these other recruits are talking up UCLA and this concert that's going on during their official visits, and the whole time Adoree Jackson was actually at USC on their campus, and that's when I sort of knew Adoree Jackson going to USC. The next question comes from SCPA5 again, who gets one question out of three because we're still on the first page. His first question is, was 2012 the best offensive line prospects you've seen? So looking back at 2012, it was definitely a very good class. You had Kyle Murphy, you had Andres Pete, Joshua Garnett, you had Max Turek, Zach Banner, Jordan Simmons. You had quite a few very good players that USC was involved with during that class. Ronnie Stanley as well. He ended up going to Notre Dame. USC kind of backed off on him a little bit towards the end of his recruitment. That's definitely a terrific class in terms of the quantity of top players that USC was after. But you could go back and look at that 2008 class where USC ends up signing both Matt Khalil and Tyron Smith in the same class. And, by the way, got Khalil Holmes, who also played in the NFL. So you're talking about two potential first-round picks at offensive tackle in the same class. That doesn't happen very often. And in all honesty, I think from an evaluation standpoint, at that point in time, Tyron Smith and Matt Khalil were more dominant than any of those offensive tackles that I saw in person during the 2012 recruiting cycle. The next question comes from TrojanTito66, which I believe we've already covered. Going down to Jacob Stein, he asked two questions. First question is, of the 2020 recruits, which freshmen on the defensive side of the ball had potential to be impact players and which could be solid role players eventually? I realize, besides Gary Bryant, no one really will be an impact player in the coming season. I think out of that 2020 group, defensive tackle Kobe Pepe from St. John Bosco probably has the best shot at being a good contributor and role player, at least early on at USC. I don't necessarily know that he has the upside to ever be a Jay Tufele level player, but I think he actually will play early and he'll be a solid contributor throughout his career at USC. Jacob's second question is, if Byron Caldwell doesn't become a Trojan, who is the most likely we will sign that is high on our board for the second running back spot? Does Brandon Campbell count? Probably not. Right now, and take this with a grain of salt because we are in the middle of July, I would say Logan Diggs is a player that USC has some traction for, three-star, number 39 tailback out of Louisiana. They also have some traction with Tavir Dunlap, a 6-foot, 195-pound tailback, the number 14th ranked tailback, also a three-star out of Texas. I think both those players USC is doing relatively well with. You would like to see them maybe expand the board a little bit, but I have to say that I do like Tavir Dunlap's film quite a bit. He has this unique ability to slide out of tackles. He never goes down on the first hit. He does a good job preventing defenders from really being able to square up on him and hit him straight on. He also doesn't get caught from behind very often. He only runs an 11.23 in the 100 meters, but you watch him get into the open field, and he does a good job of beating some pretty good angles. The next question comes from ECD for USC, who says, GM, glad to see former players visible on the USC scene. Players like Chris Claiborne, Hayes Pollard, Lenny Vandermaid, etc. in the coaching ranks, and players like Willie McGinnis, Matt Leinart, and now Reggie Bush in the media areas. This is obviously so important for recruiting to have these kinds of guys representing the face of the school. A positive image to promote, especially now with the focus on taking back the West. My question is this. With this new marketed team on board to promote the USC football brand, will they pursue bringing in more former players to participate in some marketing capacity? Big names like Troy Polamalu, Marcus Allen, Carson Palmer, Ronnie Pete, etc. would be huge in showcasing the USC brand. The short answer to this is yes. And I think once we get back to some normalcy and the entire coaching staff and support staff are all back in the office, because remember right now it's just essential staff. So I don't know that all of the support staff is actually in the football offices. But once you get the entire staff back on campus, I think you're going to see Reggie Bush showcased first and foremost. The next question comes from Skydiver Fight On, who asks, what do you think of Patrick Mahomes' 10-year deal? You know, I'm sorry, Skydiver. I really don't pay too much attention to the NFL these days. When it comes to pro football, I watch NFL Red Zone, the draft, the combine, and the occasional Seahawk game just because I still talk to some of the coaches on that staff. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are almost at the 45-minute mark, and we're still on the first page. I don't know if I'm being long-winded or the questions are long-winded, but we're going to try to push through here and try to make sure we keep this podcast under an hour. Big Jim Trojan asked the next question, which is about offensive tackle Bram Walden, who we already covered. Moving down, we have Don Data, number 4, who asked, if Mananoa Tofono was in this class, where would he rate among the linebackers, prospects slash commits? Probably a little higher, to be honest. Of the linebackers that are actually rated as inside linebackers, it's not a very strong group. I think Tofono was ranked in the 30s in the class of 2019, so I could see him being closer to maybe 20, maybe even 19, 18, somewhere in that range for the class of 2021. He'd still be a three-star, but I think he'd be ranked a little higher. Our next question comes from TDavy93, who says, hola, GM. Two questions for you. Number one, what is something about your last job, other than money, that would have inspired you to keep working there? A few years ago, I actually had a second job while I had this job as a guitar tech. The only thing that would have inspired me to continue doing that and quit this job is if I had the education to become a sound engineer and then eventually a music producer. T. Davey's second question is, what are some of the more humorous recruiting stories you've never shared? Parentheses, doesn't have to exactly pertain to prospects who commit slash enroll at USC. Most of the really funny stories are probably a little too hot for the podcast or public consumption for that matter. I'd say the Adoree Jackson story is actually pretty humorous, considering he's tweeting like he's at UCLA for an official visit on the last weekend of recruiting. Everybody's hyping up this big weekend where they've got Puff Daddy and they've got this concert and all this stuff going on, and he's actually just chilling on campus with T. Martin at USC. That was funny. Another one that comes to mind is the recruitment of Markieff Ambles. Ambles was a four-star receiver in the 2009 or 2010 recruiting class. He had a lot of interest in USC early on in his recruitment. I remember interviewing him at the underclassmen combine in San Antonio, and he was ready to commit to USC at that point. So we go on through the year. USC offers him a scholarship and is recruiting him. Todd McNair was his lead recruiter, and during the May evaluation period, he went down to Georgia and asked around about Ambles, because Ambles had gone to two or three high schools in that many years, and his grades weren't great. So McNair, being the territorial recruiter, used his connections and asked around about Ambles, and the feedback wasn't very good. So USC ends up dropping him more or less over the summer and stops recruiting him. Fast forward, and Lane Kiffin gets hired at USC. Lane Kiffin comes to USC from Tennessee, where he was recruiting Ambles and had Ambles at the top of his board as a wide receiver. So here's Todd McNair, who basically told the kid to kick rocks. He has to go back into Georgia and start re-recruiting Ambles, which was pretty awkward. So, you know, Lane was in love with him, had a great relationship with him while he was recruiting him at Tennessee, and Lane was willing to take the gamble on his character, whereas McNair felt like it wasn't worth the risk. But at the end of the day, Lane wanted to make a splash, so Todd had to go back down to Atlanta and sort of mea culpa and try to jumpstart that recruitment again, which, to his credit, they actually ended up signing Markieff Ambles, who eventually transferred out of USC. Aztec Wrestling asked the next question. Wow, say that five times fast. Aztec Wrestling asked the next question. Aztec Wrestling asked the next question. Okay, I won't. Oregon just took another wide receiver. Could this improve our chances with Dante Thornton or any other top wide receiver? Rapid fire answer, yes, it could. The next question is from Ali for USC, who asks, just how much of a factor in the Corey Foreman recruitment is Oregon's football scholarship offer to Corey's older brother? I don't know. Obviously, it can't be that huge of a factor because we haven't heard Corey talk about playing with his older brother the same way as he's talked about playing with Mason Smith. The next question is from Gate Call, who asks, what's your opinion of the 2019 offensive line compared to the 2018 offensive line in terms of pass blocking, run blocking, and cohesion? I'm assuming this is a team question and not a recruiting question, because those classes had so few offensive linemen, there's really not a lot to compare. In terms of the team, the only thing I remember about 2018 is USC won five games. So you win five games, you're bad. 2019, a little better, not great in terms of running the football, still a lot of questions. So I mean, you know, bad, not so bad. I think that's basically the comparison there. The second question is, are you comfortable reasserting Andrew Voorhees into the starting lineup? There's a saying, beggars can't be choosers. And right now, if Andrew Voorhees is healthy, you got to put him into the starting lineup. USC doesn't have a lot of good options. They certainly don't have a lot of options with players that have starting experience. The next question comes from BU for USC, who asks, how hard is USC pursuing class of 2022 top 10 nationally ranked strong side defensive end Anthony Lucas from Chaparral High School in Scottsdale, Arizona? How hard? Algebra hard. Algebra too hard. That's how hard. No, I don't know how to gauge how hard USC is recruiting him. They have been in contact with him, and they have offered him a scholarship. So I'd say he's among one of the top players on their defensive board. The next question comes from Tyler Castillo, or Tyler Castillo Zero. Hi, Gerard. Unfortunately, after the 2019 season, we all know how harmful it can be to our recruiting. Barring another disaster like last year, what is the next biggest concern we need to have for our recruiting of the 2021 class? Are there any tea leaves we should keep an eye out for in these upcoming months that will be a telling sign of a momentum shift? Thanks for all you do. Ty from Simi Valley. That's a good question, Tyler. A tricky one to answer. I would say Aaron Armitage committing to Florida or Stanford over USC. Ethan Calvert committing to UCLA or another Pac-12 school over USC. Of the two potential decommitments that I talked about earlier in the podcast, neither of those players decommitting would derail USC's recruiting momentum. It would be a case of USC moving away from those players rather than vice versa. And again, I don't want to name names, but neither player would signify USC potentially losing recruiting momentum in the 2021 class. The next question comes from David of Troy 71, who says, "Hello, GM. If USC hits a real home run on the defensive line, can Jay Toya also make it as a guard?" No, I think USC is all in on Jay Toya playing defensive tackle. The next question comes from R.S. Schindler, who says, "Hey, GM, since the Holiday Bowl was our last chance to evaluate this team's performance in a game, what was your analysis of that game? Can you break down what you saw in our 49-24 defeat and how that may change with the new staff?" That's another one of those questions that could be a podcast in and of itself. I would say two things stood out to me about that game. Number one, USC was one-dimensional on offense. Number two, Iowa went right after USC like every other team that beat USC offensively. And that was they ran off tackle. They ran at the edges. USC was pitiful trying to contain the run on the outside last season. They were bad in previous seasons, but last season it was just sort of a meme. It was a joke. They couldn't stop it. Other teams knew they couldn't stop it. And for whatever reason, there were very little adjustments in trying to contain the run on the outside. And Iowa, of all schools, not known for having the most speedy wide receivers, the most speedy running backs, abused USC off tackle. And so will there be those adjustments? Will you see this defensive scheme be better at containing on the outside? Time will tell. I really can't say that. You're looking at a defense that was at Texas last year, schematically with completely different players, playing in a different conference where you've got a lot of programs that are very pass happy. So when you're talking about containing the run, it's really hard to see how that happens when that Texas defense was playing in dime personnel a lot of the year with three safeties. If you're a USC fan, you just hope you don't see schools like Iowa running reverses and end arounds against your defense. The next question is from Beta Trojan 64 again. He asks, "Do you see USC recruiting more dual threat quarterbacks in the future? Or is that not something Clay and company want to pursue with this offense?" I was told a few years ago from a former coach on the offensive staff that Clay Helton is not comfortable with dual threat quarterbacks. He wants a quarterback that's predictable. He wants a quarterback that will run the play that is called. And obviously when you have a dual threat quarterback, you always have that potential that they're going to tuck and run it. And Clay Helton wants to call a play and he wants that specific play executed. That was what I was told from a former offensive staff member. And by looking at who they're recruiting and the quarterbacks that they've offered, that's come to fruition. USC is recruiting predominantly pro-style quarterbacks. The next question comes from Big Nick 21 USC, who says, "GM, Sierra Wright, watching his film, I notice Loyola play a lot of off-man coverage. I never see any press coverage. Can he play press? And does what Loyola run fit what Todd Orlando is planning to run?" The only thing that I know about Todd Orlando's secondaries is that defensive backs blitz a lot. He'll use safeties. He'll use cornerbacks. He loves bringing the heat from the linebacker position and the secondary. As for Sierra Wright, at the high school level, it's actually harder to play off man than to press. So I really wouldn't read too much into that. A 6 foot, 6'1 corner at the high school level can press all day long. But you want to see them in space. You want to see cornerbacks be able to transition. And playing off man is actually a little more challenging. And it's nice that he's playing off man and not just pressing or staying back in cover two. The next question comes from Silent Commit, who asks, if you were the AD at USC and were building a new coaching staff, who would you recruit and sign among the pool of current NCAA coaches for head coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, and recruiting coordinator? That's an interesting question. If I had unlimited resources and I could hire away any coach from any college football program, I'd probably hire Kirby Smart. He comes from a great lineage under Nick Saban at Alabama, yet he's younger than Nick Saban, is a better recruiter than Nick Saban, is still a defensive coach, and I'm still one of those people that believes defense wins championships. I'd pair him up with Kevin Wilson, offensive coordinator at Ohio State. And for defensive coordinator, you could kind of play around a little bit. You could take a chance on maybe a Corey Raymond, defensive back coach at LSU, just because you know you've got Kirby Smart as your head coach, and he's going to have a lot of input into the defense that you install. Or you could go with maybe Kerry Coombs, who Ohio State just rehired from the Tennessee Titans. He's been a guy that has a great long history of developing defensive backs into the NFL. And again, he's a lights out recruiter. Look at the recruiting rankings right now and look at the top recruiters, and Kerry Coombs is at the very top. So I want a defensive coordinator that's going to be preferably a secondary coach, because you're linking him up with Kirby Smart, who is by trade a linebacker coach. As for recruiting coordinator, could go with the Dante Williams, could go with the T. Martin. Truth be told, the recruiting coordinator label position is really held more by the support staff anymore. You really don't actually have full-time assistant coaches worrying about being the recruiting coordinator. Recruiting coordinator is about logistics, it's about strategy, it's about paperwork, and most position coaches really don't want anything to do with that. So a lot of the recruiting coordinator responsibilities of 10, 15 years ago actually fall on the support staff. The next question is from Bovard74, who says, it took 11 days after last year's UCLA game before Mike Bone finally announced Clay Helton would return. The delay in going public hurt USC recruiting, which presumably Bone knew but had his reasons for waiting. Seems like an internal debate and what to do between Bone and the administration and perhaps the Board of Trustees took all that time. What actually transpired? Your insight is always appreciated. I can only give you theories on what I think happened. I think Bone and the new athletic department thought seriously about firing Clay Helton, but looking at the economics of it and looking at the options that they had available, they concluded making a move would do more harm than good in the next 5 to 7 year period. USC is not in a very good place financially, and that falls on the former athletic directors, Lynn Swann and Pat Hayden, and ultimately the Board of Trustees, because that's who hired Pat Hayden and Lynn Swann. I think this athletic department's goal now is to rebuild the football program. Not necessarily from the ground up, but I think they would like to bring in their own head coach, and they would like to build around that head coach, which I already think has started to some extent. Again, this isn't gospel. This is just theories that I have, but I think this athletic department wants to grow with the head coach and not necessarily plug someone in who's a big name. Finances obviously dictate that, but I think the culture of the new athletic department also dictates that. Could some big booster come in and persuade USC to hire an Urban Meyer? Perhaps. But I think what we've seen from USC boosters over the past couple of decades, they're more apt to pay to keep a proven winning head coach than to take the risk and gamble of going after a proven winning head coach. Unfortunately, the failure of Chip Kelly at UCLA does nothing to persuade USC boosters to change their approach. UCLA football doesn't set any standards, but at the same time, UCLA being woeful doesn't put any pressure on USC either. That's going to do it for this week's Recruiting Rant podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez. You can follow me at GMartLive on Twitter or always reach out to me with follow-up questions on The Peristyle. Thank you to all our subscribers who participated in the podcast this week. And as usual, stay tuned to USCFootball.com for the best in USC athletics and recruiting.